Hey, what you're about to listen to is the podcast version of what was a live radio segment on KPFA. Consequently, when you hear us give out a call-in number, you don't want to call it. If you're listening to this as a podcast, it is already too late, and nobody on the other end of that phone number is going to have any useful answers for you. All right, let's go to this week's Corona Calls. We're going to turn, as we do most weeks at this time, to new developments in the world of COVID-19 and other influenza-like illnesses that can make this time of year just a little bit more miserable. We're joined by Dr. John Swartzberg, Clinical Professor Emeritus of Infectious Diseases at UC Berkeley School of Public Health. Good morning, Dr. Swartzberg.
Good morning.
I want to start with a question that one of our more attentive and prolific correspondents wrote in about at the conclusion of last week's segment, and that is the version of flu that is headed our way for the winter case surge. It is apparently a matter of some concern in public health circles that the influenza A strain in circulation, H3N2, has had a fairly significant mutation, subclade K, that emerged after this year's flu vaccine was calibrated to target the influenza strains in circulation, meaning it might be a bit of a miss this year in terms of our main public health strategy for dealing with flu season. Can you walk us through what we know about the properties of this mutation?
Sure. The World Health Organization set the criteria for what the vaccine should be for this fall. They do that back in February. Typically, that would be done in conjunction with the CDC, but since Trump pulled us out of the World Health Organization and has not allowed CDC folks to communicate with the World Health Organization to any great extent, this is just coming from the WHO. The reason why I mentioned that is the WHO made a decision on the kind of flu that was circulating in the Southern Hemisphere last February. And unfortunately, sometime this spring, that flu, and as you mentioned, it's a particular one called H3N2, and it circulates every year, but it's a little worse, usually makes people a little sicker than the other one that typically circulates called H1N1. Anyway, that year, or that time in the spring, H3N2 changed just a little bit, a few sites in terms of its structure, not a lot, but a few. And that switched, we call that a drift away from where it had been. And that drift meant that the typical subclade that we had been looking at and produced the influenza vaccine against had changed a little bit. Now it's subclade K, previously was subclade J. So we are seeing now circulating a new subclade that our vaccines don't cover. In Canada, they've seen an early flu season. Even earlier, we've seen a robust, and I guess that's not the best way to describe it, but a big flu season earlier in Japan and Malaysia, for example, and in South Korea. And we don't have a lot of data about what's been circulating there, but the evidence that we have so far suggests that it's this new subclade K.
So I was looking at public health data from the United Kingdom, whose flu season seems to have kicked off a little bit better than ours. And they're reporting that the flu vaccine, which it's the same formulation they have there as we have here, seems to be effective at reducing hospitalizations in children by 70 to 75% and reducing hospitalizations in adults by 30 to 40%. Is the concern that the mutated version of the virus is still kind of growing its share of infections, that it hasn't really taken off yet?
Yeah, and I'll try and get out of the weeds then and come directly to the point. And the point is that the vaccines may not be quite as effective as we've seen previously, but they still should remain effective. They may be a little less, for example, instead of preventing hospitalization and death by 50% in older adults, it may protect at 40%. So still the odds are in far in your favor to get vaccinated, and that's the key thing. Let me just put this in perspective. This drift that I've talked about occurs all the time. Unfortunately, this occurred at a time when we don't have a vaccine for that. When the virus can also what's called shift, and that means it can dramatically change its genetic structure. When that occurs, not only might the vaccines not be that effective, but the immunity that the population has may not be that effective. And then we can see a pandemic. We're not seeing any shift at all. So I want to make that very clear. We're not seeing any shift at all in the virus. It's just drifted a little bit, so the vaccines may not be quite as effective.
A shift, this would typically be like a recombination event. Some person or animal gets infected with two different versions of the virus that are similar enough to swap genetic material and cause a whole lot of changes at once.
That's exactly right. Influenza has this structure in its nucleus of the DNA, the RNA that can easily recombine in ways that other viruses can't do. So that's why influenza causes these periodic, one of the reasons why influenza causes these periodic pandemics.
We're speaking to Dr. John Swartzberg, Clinical Professor Emeritus of Infectious Diseases at UC Berkeley School of Public Health, and he is here to answer your questions about COVID and flu season and the other things that enter circulation this time of year. The phone number, 1-800-958-9008. That's 1-800-958-9008 for your corona calls. So, Dr. Swartzberg, aside from the fact that these kind of late in the season, genetic drift mutations might have made the H3N2 flu strain in circulation or gaining circulation a slightly worse fit for the vaccines we have. Do we understand those mutations to have caused any changes to the properties of that influenza strain? Do they make it more infectious or do they produce more severe illness?
We don't know, Brian. We don't have enough data yet. There was a paper published last week from Canadian colleagues in British Columbia that described the changes that have occurred, this drift that we were talking about. But these changes were, they studied three different isolates of the virus. That was it. That's all they had at that point. So we've got a lot of science to catch up on. And what struck me about that paper, it was really well done, strong scientific work. That's the kind of work that we should have seen out of the CDC, and we would have seen out of the CDC had we had a functioning CDC. Tremendous scientists in Atlanta, Georgia, where the CDC is. Just fabulous people, but we're not seeing anything like that. We didn't even see reports when the government was shut down. We saw no reports on what influenza activity was in the United States until the government reopened. So the United States is just another example how this administration has really threatened the health of our public.
All right, one more news development I want to run through before we start bringing in some questions from the phone lines at 1-800-958-9008. We've had a reported human bird flu infection, this in Washington state, and the bird flu strain is H5N5, which, as I understand it, is not the type of bird flu we were talking about a little less than a year ago. Can you walk us through both what we know about how this person got infected and what the implications are of this version of bird flu showing up in a person?
Sure. Yeah, it was a surprise to see H5N5. That, as you mentioned, that's not what we've been previously seeing here. So it just tells us that there's lots of different variations of this avian influenza that circulates. What we know about the person is that he did have a backyard flock of birds, and that's likely the way he was exposed. We don't know that with certainty, but that's likely the way he was exposed. We have seen in the United States a an upsurge of avian influenza again this year. It peaked last year in the winter, and then by the spring it was dramatically dropped. And then we've seen it come back as early as September this year. Currently, over 2 million turkeys, for example, had to be culled because of avian influenza. It looks like what's happening this year is a little bit faster and more quickly occurring in turkeys than chickens, but that's a very preliminary observation. So we are probably in for another year of avian influenza. And you had mentioned, I think, last week, the typical strain of avian influenza that's been circulating has been devastating to seals in the South Atlantic. So this is still a very significant problem, not yet significant for human beings and may never become significant for human beings, but it is a significant problem for an awful lot of mammals. I mentioned turkeys. I should reassure people that we have no reported human cases of bird flu from eating turkeys or chickens, for that matter. We do have, as long as they're cooked and cooked thoroughly, internal chip temperature up to 160, you should get to 165 degrees Fahrenheit to kill and then activate the viruses. So don't eat any raw food, turkey or chicken, for example, and don't feed it to your pets because certainly we've seen it spread that way.
Oh. Do we have a sense? I'm glad you brought up the 2 million turkeys that had to be culled. Do we have a sense of how significant a role concentrated animal feeding operations, these kind of industrial chicken farms and turkey farms, how big a role they play in helping the virus mutate and adapt?
Sure. I think while we don't have as much science as we'd like, I think it's a very fair statement to say that whenever you take animals, whether they're birds or cattle or whatever, and you congregate them in very crowded conditions, this is not good for those animals, but it's great for the virus because it allows very rapid spread. So you amplify the virus tremendously in the birds, for example. And that amplification allows the virus to do a lot more experimenting with its genetic structure to optimize its ability to infect, in this case, birds. So it's a very serious concern. And the fact that we see these millions of birds, saw these millions of birds last year had to be having to be culled, tells us that when the virus attacks birds in these congregate settings, the only way to stop it is to kill all the birds. And so it's just not ideal at all.
All right, that takes us to 7:47 in the morning. We'll bring in listener questions at this point. 1-800-958-9008 to put a Corona call to Dr. John Swartzberg. First on the lines, we have Aid in Berkeley. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. I'd like to see if the professor agrees with me. H5N7 is more lethal than all of the other bird flus, and we're in very, very bad position for that. We have migrant birds that bring all of these viruses to, domestic animals, and with the current horrible attitude of the current administration, Robert Kennedy Jr. and so on, we are really facing a devastating pandemic. We 1918 pandemic. Over 680,000 Americans died. Over 70 million worldwide people died. So we are really we have to consider seriously, because viruses change, or and what we the worst if the of the bird flu become airborne. It is only one mutation away. If that happens, we'll be talking about hundreds of millions of people dying worldwide, probably millions. Again, in nine, the COVID killed over 1.2 million Americans because of Trump denial of the virus for many, many months. and we're facing the same horrible situation again. Thank you, great show, and really appreciate having great UC professor as I was many years ago. Thank you, and good luck. Let's hope for the best.
Thank you, Aid. I think the question in there was about H1N7, which is a different strain of avian influenza than what we were discussing. Dr. Swartzberg?
Yeah. The H and the N stand for the two different proteins on the surface of all influenza viruses, and that's how we categorize them. So that's where we get these funny names like H1N1, H5N7, H5N5, and so on. What the caller was referring to was H5N7. This particular one has been seen around the world. It hasn't been the predominant one here in North America yet, but around the world it has caused a lot of damage to primarily, but not exclusively, poultry. But it also has infected human beings, and when it has, it's been very, very serious, with a very significant mortality rate. So we're always looking at how this virus is changing. And so, yes, as the caller mentioned, H5N7 is certainly one that we've had our eye on for quite a while. What the only thing separating H5N7 and all the other avian influenza strains from causing a disaster for human beings is its ability to, quote, learn. I'm anthropomorphizing the virus, but so it learns to be able to infect with facility human beings and then transmit person to person. This virus has been around for around 30 years, these avian influenza strains that we've been following. And to date, it has not, quote, learned how to be effectively transmit person to person. But that doesn't mean that tomorrow it could. So your caller's absolutely right. We need to be much more vigorous in our approach to this virus. And let me point out one last thing. This spring, RFK Jr. canceled mRNA research, $500 million worth of mRNA research into studying avian influenza. And the monitoring we're doing currently from a national level by the USDA and the CDC on avian influenza has dramatically dropped compared to last year. So we're doing the opposite of what we should be doing, and we're putting ourselves in danger.
All right, next up we've got Alicia here in Berkeley. Good morning.
Good morning. I have a comment and a question. My comment is that I heard your news this morning saying that Trump is pushing the use of toxic chemicals, and no mention was made of the fact that the pandemic of Parkinson's disease are now suspecting is being caused by some of these really toxic chemicals. So I hope that you'll include that in future news reports. And then my question is, I have several friends who've gotten what they, you know, thought was the flu or the cold or something, and then they would be fine, and then it would come back again with the same symptoms. And I just wondered, is that more typical of a flu virus, or is that more typical of a cold, or neither one, where it comes back again?
So, Dr. Swartzberg, I guess we're asking about a resurgence in symptoms that seems too soon to be a second infection.
Yes. We see that with viral respiratory infections, not uncommonly, where people start to get better and then seem to relapse a few days later. They may not get completely well, but then their symptoms get worse again. We see that very commonly with the common cold viruses, of which rhinovirus is the main one, but also coronaviruses in the same family as COVID can do that. We've seen relapses, certainly, with COVID, and that's well described. Up to maybe 20% of people who have COVID will get a relapse. Almost always that relapse is less severe. So Alicia's comment about her observation that she has several friends who seem to get better and then start to get worse again, that's not uncommon at all, but it's not specific for influenza virus, RSV, COVID. A little more commonly seen with the typical cold viruses, but it's seen with all of them.
So with COVID, I've had rebound COVID thanks to the proliferation of cheap at-home tests. I could kind of track the levels of virus in my nose over the course of the initial set of symptoms and the rebound. With rebound COVID, it was an actual rebound in levels of virus in my body. Do we understand that to be the same mechanism for resurgent symptoms with a rhinovirus or another coronavirus?
We don't have a lot of data on that. You know, not until we had these rapid tests that you could do at home could we really do things like you were doing, Brian, in terms of following and getting a sense of what the virus was doing in your own body. And we certainly need this kind of information. It reminds me to tell the listeners that you can get a combined COVID and influenza test in the pharmacy. And that's not a bad idea, perhaps, to have them on hand during this upcoming winter season, because clinically, you can't really differentiate between COVID and flu and RSV and even a common cold. So these tests are really critical.
Before we let you go, Dr. Swartzberg, we should probably talk about holiday precautions for people who are traveling and gathering for Thanksgiving or the holidays that come afterwards. I think most people who listen to this segment probably have the standard COVID precautions drilled into their heads. If you're on crowded transit, you probably want a mask en route to your destination where you're gathering with loved ones. You may want to ask people to test before gathering, crack a window while you're eating together if it's not too cold outside. But what about influenza? We don't have the same proliferation of public health advice on dealing with influenza season. What can you do to make sure you're not getting it or passing it on to people you care about?
Sure. Yeah, we're not getting the same public health advice because the CDC is really canceled, as of last February, almost all communication to the public about how to prevent influenza, which is another story. It's the standard things that we talked about. We've talked about so many times, Brian, making sure you're up to date with your vaccines, wearing a good mask N95, for example, if you're traveling on the airplane, wear it in the airport and on the plane. Those are the standard things that everybody sort of knows about. Another thing is if you're not feeling well, don't go to the Thanksgiving party. Even if the test is negative, and if you've got respiratory symptoms, stay away from other people. Don't ruin their vacation, their holiday as well. And I mentioned earlier, people often forget about what they're eating. We're seeing a lot more norovirus now. It's starting to come back up again. The norovirus causes vomiting and usually a little bit of diarrhea as well and can really ruin your holiday. So be sure you do hygienic things like washing your hands after you've handled food and washing them with soap and water. For norovirus, the alcohol preparations don't work. So it's really using soap and water to get that virus off your hands. And cooking your food well, which I mentioned earlier today, the turkey really needs to get to 165 degrees Fahrenheit. And you have to make sure that that internal temperature gets there, particularly if you're going to put stuffing in the turkey, which I don't advise because it's often hard to get that stuffing up to 165. So make sure that the turkey or whatever else you're eating is cooked well, but especially birds. So those are some of the things that I think about, Brian.
Well, I just learned something about stuffing. Dr. Swartzberg, we'll leave it there for this week. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
All right, that does it for this week's edition of Corona Calls. If you want to send in a question for next week's, you can email coronacalls@kpfa.org. Or tune in live to Call In Live. Usually we air Monday mornings right after 7:30 news headlines on KPFA 94.1 FM in the Bay Area or kpfa.org anywhere in the world. We put a little bit of extra work into repackaging this live segment as a podcast because it feels like the information is useful to a lot of people. We ought to make it accessible through as many channels as possible. You can help us get the word out by rating and reviewing it in whatever app you're using to listen. And if you want to pitch in some cash, we wouldn't say no. We always take donations at kpfa.org. I appreciate it if you mentioned Corona Calls when you make your pledge. My name is Brian Edwards-Tiekert. I hope you have a great week. Stay well. We'll talk to you next time.